You're listening to WikiSleep, a podcast designed to help you relax and unwind through calm, quiet storytelling. I'm your host, Adrian Sala. If you're among the thousands of people who listen to this podcast each week, you're probably aware that WikiSleep is becoming an app. The app will have all the same great content as the podcast, plus much more. There will be ambient, brainwave tracks for sleep, new stories and histories, additional narrators, sound baths, and a bunch of other great sleepy content all designed to help you switch off and wind down. I strongly encourage you to go to wikisleep.com and sign up for early and extended free access. It only takes a few seconds and will help me immensely once the app is launched. I should also mention that once it is launched, all the content you find through this podcast will only be available there. So simply go to wikisleep.com and add yourself to the growing list of listeners already signed up for what I promise will be a fun and effective app. Tonight, I'll be reading to you about Tulip Mania, a true story from a book called Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay. The book itself is an exploration on the oddity of human behavior and the strange things we, as a group, have collectively made happen, such as the mass hysteria behind the Salem witch trials. In this story of delusion, we'll be hearing about one of the first financial bubbles to ever happen and, perhaps the most peculiar, in which Dutch tulips became so inflated in value that they were traded as currency on the Dutch Stock Exchange. At the height of the hysteria, tulip brokers made and lost fortunes. Wealthy people became poor, poor people became wealthy. And then it all came crashing down and left people holding the flowers broke and optionless. The tulip, so named it is said from a Turkish word signifying a turban, was introduced to Western Europe about the middle of the 16th century. Conrad Gesner, who claims the merit of having brought it into repute, little dreaming of the commotion it was shortly afterward to make in the world, says that he first saw it in the year 1559 in a garden at Augsburg, belonging to the learned counselor, Herwart, a man very famous in his day for his collection of rare exotics. The bulbs were sent to this gentleman by a friend at Constantinople, where the flowers had long been a favorite. In the course of 10 or 11 years after this period, tulips were much sought after by the wealthy, especially in Holland and Germany. Rich people at Amsterdam sent for the bulbs direct to Constantinople and paid the most extravagant prices for them. The first roots planted in England were brought from Vienna in the year 1600. Until 1634, the tulip annually increased in reputation, until it was deemed a proof of bad taste in any man of fortune to be without a collection of them. Many learned men, including Pompeius de Angelis and the celebrated Lipsius of Leyden, the author of the treatise De Constantia, were passionately fond of tulips. The rage for possessing them soon caught the middle classes of society, and merchants and shopkeepers, even of moderate means, began to vie with each other in the rarity of these flowers, and the preposterous prices they paid for them. A trader at Harlem was known to pay one half of his fortune for a single root, not with the design of selling it again at a profit, but to keep in his own conservatory for the admiration of his acquaintance. One would suppose that there must have been some great virtue in this flower to have made it so valuable in the eyes of so prudent a people as the Dutch. But it has neither the beauty nor the perfume of the rose, hardly the beauty of the sweet, sweet pea. Neither is it as enduring as either. Cowley, it is true, is loud in its praise, he says. The tulip next appeared, all over gay, but wanton, full of pride and full of play. The world can't shew a dye, but here has place. Nay, by new mixtures she can change her face. Purple and gold are both beneath her care, the richest needlework she loves to wear. Her only study is to please the eye, and to outshine the rest in finery. This, though not very poetical, is the description of a poet. Beckmann, in his History of Inventions, paints it with more fidelity and in prose more pleasing than Cowley's poetry. He says, "There are few plants which acquire, through accident, weakness, or disease, so many variations as the tulip." When uncultivated and in its natural state, it is almost of one color, has large leaves and an extraordinary long stem. When it has been weakened by cultivation, it becomes more agreeable in the eyes of the florist. The petals are then paler, smaller, and more diversified in hue. And the leaves acquire a softer green color. Thus, this masterpiece of culture, the more beautiful it turns, grows so much the weaker, so that, with the greatest skill and most careful attention, it can scarcely be transplanted, or even kept alive. Many persons grow insensibly attached to that which gives them a great deal of trouble, as a mother often loves her sick and ever ailing child better than her most healthy offspring. Upon the same principle, we must account for the unmerited encomia lavished upon these fragile blossoms. In 1634, the rage among the Dutch to possess them was so great that the ordinary industry of the country was neglected, and the population, even to its lowest dregs, embarked in the tulip trade. As the mania increased, prices augmented until, in the year 1635, many persons were known to invest a fortune of 100,000 florins in the purchase of 40 roots. It then became necessary to sell them by their weight in perits, a small weight less than a grain. A tulip of the species called Admiral Lifken, weighing 400 perits, was worth 4,400 florins. An Admiral van der Eyck, weighing 446 perits, was worth 1,260 florins. A chalder of 106 perits was worth 1,615 florins. A viceroy of 400 perits credits, 3,000 florins. And, most precious of all, a Semper Augustus, weighing 200 parrots, was thought to be very cheap at 5,500 florins. The latter was much sought after, and even an inferior bulb might command a price of 2,000 florins. It is related that, at one time in early 1636, there were only two roots of this description to be had in all Holland, and those not of the best. One was in the possession of a dealer in Amsterdam, and the other in Haarlem. So anxious were the speculators to obtain them, that one person offered the fee of 12 acres of building ground for the Haarlem tulip. That of Amsterdam was bought for 4,600 florins, a new carriage, two gray horses, and a complete suit of harness. People who had been absent from Holland and whose chance it was to return when this folly was at its maximum were sometimes led into awkward dilemmas by their ignorance. There is an amusing instance of the kind related in Blainville's Travels. A wealthy merchant who prided himself not a little on his rare tulips received upon one occasion a very valuable consignment of merchandise from the Levant. Intelligence of its arrival was brought him by a sailor who presented himself for that purpose at the counting house, bales of goods of every description. The merchant, to reward him for his news, munificently made him a present of a fine red herring for his breakfast. The sailor had, it appears, a great partiality for onions, and seeing a bulb very like an onion lying upon the counter of this liberal trader, and thinking it, no doubt, very much out of its place among the silks and velvets, he slyly seized an opportunity and slipped it into his pocket as a relish for his herring. He got clear off with his prize and proceeded to the quay to eat his breakfast. Hardly was his back turned when the merchant missed his valuable Semper Augustus, worth 3,000 florins. The whole establishment was instantly in an uproar. Searches everywhere were made for the precious root, but it was not to be found. Great was the merchant's distress of mind. The search was renewed, but again without success. At last, someone thought of the sailor. The unhappy merchant sprang into the street at the bare suggestion. His alarm household followed him. The sailor, simple soul, had not thought of concealment. He was found quietly sitting on a coil of ropes, masticating the last morsel of his onion. Little did he dream that he had been eating a breakfast whose cost might have regaled the whole ship's crew for a 12-month. Or, as the plundered merchant expressed it himself, might have sumptuously feasted the Prince of Orange and the whole court of the Stadtholder. Anthony caused pearls to be dissolved in wine to drink to the health of Cleopatra. Sir Richard Whittington was as foolishly magnificent in an entertainment to King Henry V, and Sir Thomas Gresham drank a diamond dissolved in wine to the health of Queen Elizabeth when she opened the Royal Exchange. But the breakfast of this roguish Dutchman was as splendid as either. He had an advantage, too, over his wasteful predecessors. Their gems did not improve the taste or the wholesomeness of their wine, while his tulip was quite delicious with his red herring. The most unfortunate part of the business for him was that he remained in prison for some months on charge of felony preferred against him by the merchant. Another story is told of an English traveler, which is scarcely less ludicrous. This gentleman, an amateur botanist, happened to see a tulip root lying in the conservatory of a wealthy Dutchman. Being ignorant to its quality, he took out his penknife and peeled off its coat with the view of making experiments upon it. When it was by this means reduced to half its size, he cut it into two equal sections, making all the time many learned remarks on the singular appearance of the unknown bulb. Suddenly, the owner pounced on him and, with fury in his eyes, asked him if he knew what he had been doing. "Peeling a most extraordinary onion," replied the philosopher. 100,000 duivel," cried the Dutchman. "It's an Admiral van der Eyck." "Thank you," replied the traveler, taking out his notebook to make a memorandum of the same. "Are these admirals common in your country?" "Death and the devil," said the Dutchman, seizing the astonished man of science by the collar. "Come before the syndic and you shall see." In spite of his remonstrances, the traveler was led through the streets, followed by a mob of persons. When brought into the presence of the magistrate, he learned, to his consternation, that the root upon which he had been experimentalizing was worth 4,000 florins, and, notwithstanding all he could urge in extenuation, he was lodged in prison until he found securities for the payment of this sum. The demand for tulips of a rare species increased so much in the year 1636 that regular marts for their sale were established on the Stock Exchange of Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, Haarlem, Leiden, Alkmaar, Hoorn, and other towns. Symptoms of gambling now became, for the first time, apparent. The stock jobbers, ever on the alert for a new speculation, dealt largely in tulips, making use of all the means they so well knew how to employ to cause fluctuations in prices. At first, as in all these gambling mania, confidence was at its height and everybody gained. The tulip jobbers speculated in the rise and fall of the tulip stocks and made large profits by buying when prices fell and selling when they rose. Many individuals grew suddenly rich. A golden bait hung temptingly out before the people, and one after the other they rushed to the tulip marts like flies around a honey pot. Everyone imagined that the passion for tulips would last forever, and that the wealthy from every part of the world would send to Holland and pay whatever prices were asked for them. The riches of Europe would be concentrated on the shores of Zuider Zee, and poverty banished from the favored clime of Holland. Nobles, citizens, farmers, mechanics, seamen, footmen, maidservants, even chimney sweeps and old clothes women, dabbled in tulips. People of all grades converted their property into cash and invested it in flowers. Houses and lands were offered for sale at ruinously low prices, or assigned in payment of bargains made at the tulip mart. Foreigners became smitten with the same frenzy, and money poured into Holland from all directions. The prices of the necessaries of life rose again by degrees. Houses and lands, horses and carriages, and luxuries of every sort rose in value with them, and for some months Holland seemed the very antechamber of Plutus. The operations of the trade became so extensive and so intricate that it was found necessary to draw up a code of laws for the guidance of dealers. Notaries and clerks were also appointed, who devoted themselves exclusively to the interests of the trade. The designation of public notary was hardly known in some towns, that of tulip notary usurping its place. In the smaller towns where there was no exchange, the principal tavern was usually selected as the show place where high and low traded in tulips and confirmed their bargains over sumptuous entertainments. These dinners were sometimes attended by 200 or 300 persons, and large vases of tulips in full bloom were placed at regular intervals upon the tables and sideboards for their gratification during the repast. At last, however, the more prudent began to see that this folly could not last forever. Rich people no longer bought the flowers to keep them in their gardens, but to sell them again at a cent per cent profit. It was seen that somebody must lose fearfully in the end. As this conviction spread, prices fell and never rose again. Confidence was destroyed, and a universal panic seized upon the dealers. A had agreed to purchase 10 Semper Augustines from B at 4,000 florins each at 6 weeks after the signing of the contract. B was ready with the flowers at the appointed time, but the price had fallen to 300 or 400 florins, and A refused either to pay the difference or receive the tulips. Defaulters were announced day after day in all the towns of Holland. Hundreds who, a few months previously, had begun to doubt that there was such a thing as poverty in the land, suddenly found themselves the possessors of a few bulbs which nobody would buy, even though they offered them at 1/4 the sums they had paid for them. The cry of distress resounded everywhere, and each man accused his neighbor. The few who had contrived to enrich themselves hid their wealth from the knowledge of their fellow citizens and invested it in the English or other funds. Many who, for a brief season, had emerged from the humbler walks of life were cast back into their original obscurity. Substantial merchants were reduced almost to beggary, and many a representative of a noble line saw the fortunes of his house ruined beyond redemption. When the first alarm subsided, tulip holders in several towns held public meetings to devise what measures were best to be taken to restore public credit. It was generally agreed that deputies should be sent from all parts to Amsterdam to consult with the government upon some remedy for the evil. The government had first refused to interfere, but advised the tulip holders to agree to some plan among themselves. Several meetings were held for this purpose, but no measure could be devised likely to give satisfaction to the deluded people or repair even a slight portion of the mischief that had been done. A language of complaint and reproach was in everybody's mouth, and all the meetings were of the most stormy character. At last, however, after much bickering and ill will, it was agreed at Amsterdam by the assembled deputies that all contracts made in the height of the mania or prior to the month of November 1636 should be declared null and void, and that in those made after that date, purchasers should be freed from their engagements on paying 10% to the vendor. This decision gave no satisfaction. The vendors who had had their tulips on hand were, of course, discontented, and those who had pledged themselves to purchase thought themselves hardly treated. Tulips which had, at one time, been worth 6,000 florins were now to be procured for 500, so that the composition of 10% was 100 florins more than the actual value. Actions for breach of contract were threatened in all the courts of the country, but the latter refused to take cognizance of gambling transactions. The matter was finally referred to the Provincial Council at The Hague, and it was confidently expected that the wisdom of this body would invent some measure by which credit should be restored. Expectation was on the stretch for its decision, but it never came. The members continued to deliberate week after week, and at last, after thinking about it for 3 months, declared that they could offer no final decision until they had more information. They advised, however, that, in the meantime, every vendor should, in the presence of a witness, offer the tulips in natura to the purchaser for the sums agreed upon. If the latter refused to take them, they might be put up for sale by public auction, and the original contractor held responsible for the difference between the actual and the stipulated price. This was exactly the plan recommended by the deputies, and which was already shown to be of no avail. There was no court in Holland which would enforce payment. The question was raised in Amsterdam, but the judges unanimously refused to interfere on the grounds that debts contracted in gambling were no debts in law. Thus, the matter rested. To find a remedy was beyond the power of the government. Those who were unlucky enough to have had stores of tulips on hand at the time of the sudden reaction were left to bear their ruin as philosophically as they could. Those who had made profits were allowed to keep them. But the commerce of the country suffered a severe shock from which it was many years ere it recovered.